So tonight's talk is titled Thoughts on Non-Self. It's a topic I've been exploring, and the more I explore what people have said, I keep finding all these different perspectives on it. And so this, I'm going to try and sort of synthesize all these different ways of thinking about non-self from different teachers and different books and different ways of looking at things. Some very intellectual, some psychological, some very traditional. Somehow they all fit together, I think. So the first of these is looking at how simply by the language we use, how we speak about self, creates a sense of separate self. Like language is the what is the, in some sense, the root cause of our thinking about ourself has been separate. And I want to look at first of all how the language itself think. So this here's five different ways we might think about or define our self, you know, in quotes, self, right? So someone will ask you, well, how old are you? And I'll say, well, I'm 73 years old. Well, there's I am. So I'm just identified with my body, you know, this body, which happens to be 73 years old. So this is all identification, and it's one of the prime ways, of course, that we think about who I am. I'm my body, of course. But then someone might also ask you, what color are your eyes? And you say, my eyes are blue. Now, you aren't your body, but somehow you possess the body. My eyes, now they become a possession. So these are two different flavors of that idea. But then think about how we speak about emotions. I am sad. I am happy. These are who I am, is this emotional energy. That's what I identify most strongly with. I think of myself as being this energy, these emotions. But once again, you know, I might say something like, you're talking and you're saying, well, my joys and sorrows. Oh, wait, now my emotions have become my possession again. They're my joys, my sorrows, my trials and tribulations. You know, so now we have four ways already. This, I am the body, I own the body, I'm a possessor of the body. I am my emotions, I am the possessor of my emotions. And then we have what's also very common is like, I somehow think of myself as the observer of all this, you know, that somewhere back in the back of my brain or something like that, who knows where this eye actually hangs out, it's just observing and noticing things as they go by. So now my eye is centered around the idea of consciousness. I am somehow my consciousness. So these are typical uses of language around this concept of self. And then what I want to do is I want to read a couple of passages. This is from Guy Armstrong's book, Emptiness, where he talks about this quite succinctly. We've now found five meanings for I, as the body, as the owner of the body, the emotions, the owner of the emotions, and the observer. Which are you, really? You might reply, I'm all of them. I'm my body and it belongs to me. I'm my thoughts and feelings and they belong to me. And I'm something apart from them watching it all. I'm everything you said, all wrapped up in one, which it, I think is actually quite an accurate description of how we might think about it. We're not typically very unitary about this. I'm not just one of those things. I'm all five of them somehow magically blended together. And then Guy goes on. We've now arrived at the conventional understanding of the self. In this culture, when we talk about what I am, it's this whole package. This is what we mean by a person. It's what we mean by I. We've now arrived at a place where, upon looking closely, the absurdity of conventional understanding becomes apparent. Guy doesn't cut to the chase here. How many selves are you? Are you the self as the organ of your liver and also as the emotion of compassion? Are these the same I or different? Are you a self as your political view and as your consciousness that hears a bird call? Are these the same I or different? Are you a self who is changing every moment as the body does with its pulses and respiration and digestion? Or are you an ongoing self who is stable observer of the changes? Are these the same I or different? When we look into these questions, what we will find are little more than a collision of unexamined language habits around I and mine. We'll read that sentence again. When we look into these questions, what we find are little more than collisions of unexamined language habits around I and mine. One is reminded of the famous comment by Ludwig Wittgenstein that the self is only a shadow cast by grammar. We have found these terms useful to distinguish one person from another in social dialogue and to establish social guidelines around possessions. But by not examining the terms closely, we have stretched the idea of self so far that it does not actually make sense. Like, there's too many options here, all of which are supposed to be true at the same time, somehow or other. And then in another place in this book, Guy has something else to say. He says, and this is also important. It's fine to say I and mine and you and yours, as long as you understand that these terms are merely conventions of our social contract that identify where an activity is taking place or where ownership is assigned. With these useful conventions, you end up in your own home and I end up in mine after driving our respective cars. Life would be too chaotic without these conventions and the language we use to communicate about them. So these are, it's not saying we shouldn't use the words I and me and mine. And there are people who try to do that. Like they start, I'm never going to utter those words. This has become like a philosophical position, you know, or an exercise, which just creates great and massive amounts of confusion and chaos. But at the same time, what he's saying is, though this is, it's okay, we need this, we need these conventions. We have to be careful that we don't just start believing that those definitions we have created about ourselves by using language are who we are. It's and it can sometimes be skillful, you know, especially during meditation practice, when you feel a strong emotion is arising, instead of thinking, which we usually would do, I'm angry, I'm experiencing anger, you can see if you can just shift that thought to anger has arisen. There's no my there anymore, no I in mine. It's just, this is what's happening now. Anger is what's present now, or joy, or whatever. And it just, if we can start as we note and pay attention to what's arising in the moment, take the I and me and mine out of our thoughts, in a sense, we start to get a clearer view of what's really going on, which is just this constant flow of things arising and passing away. In fact, a useful definition of I that you might play with, and this is once again from Guy Armstrong, I'm paraphrasing what he said once, I am a part of the ever-changing flow of experience, of things constantly arising and passing away, conventionally known as Barry. So it's like, you sort of have this sense of I as being just part of this always changing, continuously flowing. So there's no solidity. There's no permanence to anything. So we still need that sense of I. I mean, here's an interesting contradiction in a sense. And I've heard this said from many different teachers. We have to have, if we're going to actually go deeply into this practice, we'd better have a fairly solid sense of self. If we don't have a good sense of self, then as we go deeper into the practice, we can become very confused. This is, this is where people have psychotic episodes during meditation practice, because it arises from not having a solid enough sense. You have to have a solid sense of self so you can see that it isn't true. Which is a pretty big paradox, but that's the idea behind what I've been talking about. So one whole way of looking at this thing about non-self is this idea of how we create the self strictly by language. If we didn't have language, it's an interesting thought. If we didn't have language, we wouldn't have a sense of separate self. It would just be part of the organic flow of things going on. Just like the sparrow on the bird feeder. Does it think, boy, that's me here eating these free sunflower seeds? No, it's just part of the flow of what's going on around there. And that's all that's going on. There's no sense of separate self there, because there's no cognitive identity and no language to create that sense of self. So that's thoughts number one. Thoughts number two is an interesting sort of psychological, psychotherapeutic way of looking at these things. And I recently read this wonderful book called The Zen of Therapy, Uncovering a Hidden Kindness in Life by Mark Epstein, MD. Now, Mark is a longtime meditator. He's one of the original students of Joseph Goldstein. He's been practicing for 40 years, but he's also a highly trained psychotherapist in the very traditional psychotherapeutic tradition, traditional in some ways anyway. And people come and they lie down on the couch or they sit and they talk to him, right? So he has that talking therapy process. And in this book, I came across some really interesting things. I want to read some of it, talk about some of it. Here's another totally different way to look at this question. And he starts, this is a whole section. He says, the heart of the Buddha's message is that there is no self. Is a very true statement. I mean, if you really look at what the Buddha is talking about, more than anything else he's talking about, this is the most important thing we have to figure out, we have to realize, we have to have insight into. What he meant by that is open to interpretation. And there's no end of debate about it over centuries. But however we choose to understand it, there's no question that he was getting at something profound, difficult to comprehend, and central to his teachings. Rather than digging too deeply into the endless academic debates about this core doctrine, where the language of philosophy threatens to overwhelm the felt truth of this bold statement, let's stay close to the actual words. There is no self. How strange. I don't know whether you react the same way as I do, but I actually find this relieving. Deep down, I have never been sure that I had a self, or enough of a self, or the right kind of self, or that my self was okay, or that it was even there. What self? I looked at my parents and they had selves. I looked at my friends and siblings and they had selves. I looked at the other boys in my class and they seemed to have selves. And the girls, no question, definitely had selves. But my own self was hard to pin down. There were swirls of thoughts and feelings for sure, and certainly a recurrent sense of inadequacy and feelings coupled with a wish to please and happiness when I was praised or pride when I was successful at something. But from an early age, I had this nagging kind of doubt that when I compared myself with others around me, no, not self-doubt as much as doubts about my own completeness. How I seemed from the inside did not match up with how other people appeared from the outside. Was I who I was supposed to be, or was I somehow wanting? There wasn't much I could do about this question. I pretty much had to bury it and just pretend. Now that I'm a psychiatrist and have been treating people for 40 years, I know that these kinds of feelings are far from unique. In one form or another, they might even be the norm. So that's pretty interesting to start with. Then he goes on to explain different models that have come and gone in the therapeutic community, in the psychotherapy community, starting with Freud. So I'm not going to read all of that because it's pretty dense, but it's pretty interesting. He said, what Freud said is that young people like 5, 6, 7 year olds have sexual feelings towards their parents, coupled with a sense of inadequacy, of not being good enough. And that's where these problems arose. It was from, they looked at their bodies and their bodies were incomplete compared to the adults around them. But they were somehow attracted to them, but didn't feel like they could in any way be adequately appropriate for them. Interesting theory. and much of his Freud psychotherapeutic process revolved around this idea. Then sort of later on in that sequence of people talking about and understanding what was going on at the therapy level was the idea that all children, this is without exception, all children have unbridled anger at caregivers who would never be enough or give enough. That somehow or other, part sort of the root energy of being small and young was that you were angry at your parents because they could never satisfy you, because at 5 or 6 you think the world revolves around you, right? I mean, everything is about you. And so when you didn't get your way about something, you'd have a temper tantrum or you'd sulk or whatever your particular habits were. But it was always like, they don't love me enough, they don't give me enough, what's wrong with them? what's wrong with me that they don't give me enough, that they're not good at, they just can't do it. This theory then evolved to the next layer, which was what's called attachment theory, where now the children just need what's called a good enough parent. The parent doesn't have to be perfect. The parent doesn't have to give them everything all the time, but they have to be good enough, which means that you let kids learn about life without being too intrusive. So they let them sort of struggle, or too abandoning, got to be there, or too chaotic. Well, you're there, but it's like the house is total chaos all the time. These models of parenting being too intrusive, too abandoning, or too chaotic were the root cause of many people's issues. And this was sort of what drove psychotherapeutic practice and teaching for now 100 years now, a bit more than 100 years. And then along comes my good friend here, Mark Epstein, and he says, wait a second. And this is where it gets interesting. All of these theories, so cogent and persuasive, treat underlying feelings of doubt about the self as pathological, and so seek explain them not by not so obliquely finding someone or something to blame. Well, it sounds like a lot of our culture, right? As you can see from the various examples I've recounted in this book, I found each of these models helpful in individual cases, but I do not think it necessary to pathologize the entire phenomenon of doubts about the self. Who gets out of their childhood intact? Good question. When we presume that a core self exists, we are forced to consider intimations of no self as signs of emotional illness or developmental lapses. An industry is being made out of blaming one's mother for such feelings, as if the very existence is proof of a parent's deficiency. The Buddha's teachings run counter to this tendency to find fault. He normalized feelings of inadequacy and threw responsibility back onto the individual to sort them out. He taught mindfulness as a method of probing the self and found that impartial attention to moment experience yields surprising but predictable insight into the self's contingent and relational nature. These insights, which precipitate spontaneously out of concentrated attention and mindful reflection, make abundantly clear that our habitual efforts to defend ourselves against our intrinsic groundlessness make things even worse. As Samuel Beckett once put it, the ego, the minister of dullness, is also the agent of security. And then he goes on. But the Buddha's view is that good enough can never be good enough. That there's always a leftover feeling of something missing, something wrong, something hard to face, or something out of reach. And that this can be beneficial as it prompts a search for the real. Even with good enough upbringing and the consolidation of what might be called a good enough self, according to the Buddha's logic, there will still be disquiet, confusion, and insecurity because we are all instinctively struggling to be something independent, solid, coherent, and self-sufficient we can never be. read that sentence again because I think it's key to what he's arguing. Even in healthy personality development, we emerge from childhood defending against the underlying truth of how contingent and provisional and dependent we actually are. The persistence of such feelings, far from being a symptom of parental failures, even if there have been such failures, is actually the seed of wisdom. Fighting against this only rigidifies our defenses and isolates us further. Acknowledging the emptiness that frightens us, whatever source it may be, is the key to a deeper and truer understanding. The emptiness that we fear is not really empty. When it is successfully turned into an object of awareness, it reveals itself to be vast, luminous, and reassuring, albeit mysteriously alive. So what he's pointing to here, I think, is really interesting. He's saying that the root cause lying underneath perhaps some very difficult experiences in childhood, which people have for sure, or young adulthood for that matter. There's this sense that we keep trying to create this sense of a solid self over and over and over and over again. And then we can't find it because it's not there. As much as we want to be independent, solid, coherent, and self-sufficient, as he says, we can't be. Because that implies that there is something solid and coherent there that we can hook onto. So from a psychotherapeutic point of view, because this is all coming straight from psychotherapy, blended with Buddhism, obviously, the key thing we have to figure out, the key thing we have to somehow realize, intuit, have insight into, is this sense that really the sense of separate self is just the problem. That's the key root problem. So it brings about all the other problems, whether they be simple, us struggling to try and figure out our life, to much deeper problems that are more aptly treated in a psychotherapeutic environment. So that's I think this is a really interesting view of this problem of no self from a totally different point of view than I'd come across before. Okay. Then, door number three, as they say. This is a book called Direct Realization by Ajahn Sumedho. So this is, Ajahn Sumedho is a very traditional Theravadan teacher who was the Ajahn, the head monk, the main teacher, at a Wat in England. So this is a Theravadan Buddhist monastic center that he was the primary teacher of. So he was a student of Ajahn Chah's, very traditional teaching. So this is what he has to say about this same topic. So ignorance conditions the body and mind as defined by the five skandhas, the five aggregates. That is when we operate from a position of ignorance, not understanding the truth, and everything that we experience and do and say and feel is conditioned from that ignorance. Absolutely everything. This is where the self-view is such a blind spot. When we think of the karmic formation as self rather than as not self, so the karmic formation is this body mind. When we think of this as self rather than as non-self, Everything that happens, everything that is experienced is referred to that sense of a person as a physical body, me as a perception. This is ignorance. If you have the insight that all conditions are impermanent, all Dhamma is not self, then there's knowing the truth or Dhamma rather than ignorance and habitual karmic repeating of things. There's knowing the Dhamma, the truth of the way it is. All the rest follows suit. Everything is seen as it is. There's no distortion. Consciousness, the five aggregates and the sense world are seen as Dhamma rather than as self. What is your suffering in life anyway? Why do you suffer? If you investigate, you will always trace it back to this ignorance. There's a natural suffering, going hungry, getting old, getting sick, but that's all bearable. That's nothing we can't bear. Sickness, old age, and death are things we can always bear with. They're not real suffering. Suffering is the greed, hatred, and delusion we produce through self-view, through taking it all personally. The creations and attachments to wrong views, prejudices, biases, and all the horrors that we are responsible for can all be traced back to this original ignorance. We can't really expect very much improvement if we still insist on being ignorant, caught in the self-view. Even though we might be able to improve conditions slightly by trying to be a good person, as long as there is attachment to self-view, there is delusion. So even the goodness we do comes from delusion. It doesn't lead anyone out of suffering. If we don't have wisdom, often we try to do good, but end up harming and causing all kinds of problems while thinking we can tell others what is good for them. Sounds fairly familiar, right? We've all been there. What is the way? What is the way it is at this moment? Your body is sitting. You can feel things, pleasure, pain, heat, cold, whatever. This is the way things are. There's no self in that. We're not creating the self. When we bring our attention to the way things are, we can see that what we do when we add me and mine to the moment, when I think, what I feel, what I want, what I don't want, what I like, what I don't like. Or we can be aware of the selves we create in others, my opinions about you. I have suffered a lot from creating people in my mind, not because anybody was really cruel to me, but because of all the things I used to create about myself and about other people. The fear of what others thought, jealousies, envy, greed, possessiveness, would have my prejudices and views about people, what I thought they were really up to, and my suspicions of what they really wanted. So suffering comes out of the creations we make about ourselves and others, about our parents and the people closest to us. What is suffering? Really ask yourself, what is the suffering of your life? Yesterday, the cold winds were blowing through me as I was walking out there in the field. Is that suffering? I could make it suffering. I hate this cold wind. But actually, it was all right. I mean, it was something I could completely bear. If I didn't make anything about it in my mind, it was just cold wind, that's all. Yet we spend time here in Amaravati creating attitudes about monks, nuns, lay people. You can really make senior nuns into big ogres. We have strong views about seniority. If we are in a senior position, we can be very attached to it. I am senior to you. You are just a new monk. Do that. I'm the boss. So we can create ourselves as being senior monks. We are not here to create karma based on ignorance. The conventions we have are merely expedient means. They are simplifications, moral agreements, and community agreements to make life simple and uncomplicated, and also to allow us to reflect on the way we relate to people. above, senior people, equal people, junior people. The Buddha said the view that everybody is equal is a delusion. I am superior to everyone is a delusion. I am inferior is a delusion. I am is a delusion if that identity is based on ignorance. But when there is not ignorance, I am is merely a conventional reality. It's just the way we talk. I am hungry. I am Sumedho Bhikkhu, but I'm not a person. So interestingly, he's saying pretty much the same thing that Mark Epstein was saying, but from a totally different perspective, from a very traditional teachings perspective. You know, and what he came down to was this really famous little couple of sentences in a sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya. This is the Buddha speaking. When anyone on the basis of form, which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, regards themselves thus, I am superior, or I am inferior, or I am equal, what does that do to apart from not seeing things as they really are? Not seeing things as they really are. So this this comparing, this habit of comparing, which is very deeply ingrained, is often called conceit when you read the commentaries that have been written about the Buddhist teachings. And you think about the word conceit, it's like, you know, it always has, I'm better than, I'm worse than, I'm comparing myself to someone else in a way that has this better than, equal to, less than sort of vibe to it. So it's quite a good word. Also, other translations might be pride, arrogance, or measuring. This is called one of the latent torments. I love that phrase, the latent torment. So it's not something that's obvious. It's not like, you know, greed and anger and lust. You know, they're pretty obvious usually. This is something that's sort of a layer below. It's latent. It isn't sort of jumping out in front of us all the time. And if they're latent because it's so hard to see, because it seems so natural. It seems like, well, that's what everybody does. You know, here I am comparing myself to everybody again by even saying that, right? Everybody does that. Well, I'm equal to everybody else, you know? It's like we get caught in that way of thinking so easily over and over and over again. And basically, we just keep getting caught there. You know, this idea of, you know, I'm better than someone, I'm worse than someone, I'm equal to someone. They're all equally problematic. I'm going to read something from Joseph Goldstein here. This is from his book, Mindfulness. So this is, in a sense, yet another view of this idea. And he's talking, this is quite an interesting little thing he's saying here. Sometimes we worry about our practice. Have you ever done that? Ever worried about your practice? Yeah, that sounds familiar. Well, while goals and aspirations are key elements in our spiritual journey, as we should have right intention, the mind can easily be overcome by our progress. And how we think we're doing, obsessing about our enlightenment or lack of it. With this kind of worry, it's very easy to fall into self-judgment, a certain kind of spiritual self-absorption. We start comparing ourselves to other meditators, the length of our sits, the amount of food we take, how slowly we're moving, and our minds can easily get agitated by this worry about our practice. We lose the simplicity of easeful resting in the moment, mindful and of whatever is arising. So this is actually this kind of comparing mind, he goes on to say, I won't read all this stuff, is one of the root causes of restlessness, one of the kleshas. This comparing mind makes us rest, because I should be doing more. What's wrong with me? I got to do more. Or maybe I'm doing too much, and maybe I should just relax more. But how do I relax? And it's like it becomes this vicious cycle in a sense. So where does all this, I've been speaking about this not self, where does all this leave us, all these different viewpoints I've brought into the equation? I think the most important thing is these ideas about not self. This isn't something we can figure out. This isn't something we can sort of just intellectually come to the right conclusion. That's done. It just doesn't work that way. We can't ever figure this out because of the issues of language, because of the issues of mental habits, because of our emotional history, because of our latent torments of our habits of comparing, which are so deeply ingrained. But instead, as Joseph says, we lose the simplicity of easeful resting in the moment, mindful of whatever is arising. If we can just do that, if we can somehow just do the practice consciously, faithfully, being aware when we're getting caught in these unwholesome patterns, then something arises. So this understanding of not self just arises in and of itself. So Ajahn Sumedho was saying the same thing. It's like somehow or other we have to give up the idea of figuring this thing out and just let the practice make it clear. And the danger, and this is, I speak for now from very personal experience, the danger is somehow that we start to think, oh, this is a really advanced practice. This is serious advanced stuff only for those advanced people. But the truth is, if I can just be aware, just do my practice, there's moments of real clarity about not self all the time. And all we're trying to do is have them more frequently. We start to see that the things are just arising and falling away. We start to see this flow, this undercurrent that sits underneath that vast mess of experience we're always having. Underneath all that is just this flow of something arises, it's there for a while, it's gone. Something else arises, it's there for a while, it's gone. And this is the beginnings of our insight into the truth of how things are. I want to read another thing from Joseph here. And he's talking about continuity of practice and how important that is, but within the context of what I've been talking about. There's an early insight into the nature of the mind-body process that comes from this continuity of mindfulness and also strengthens it. It is the understanding through one's own experience that in every moment, knowing and each object arise simultaneously. There's the in-breath and the simultaneous knowing of it, the out-breath and the knowing of it. A visual object arises, and in that very moment, there's the knowing of it. This is true of every aspect of our experience. This insight is the first doorway into the understanding of selflessness. And in the stages of insight, it is called purification of view. We begin to see that everything that we call self is simply this pairwise progression of knowing an object, arising and passing moment after moment. And we also see that the knowing in each moment arises due to impersonal causes and does not and not because there's some abiding knower. So we can say that knowing arises spontaneously when the appropriate causes and conditions are present. Going even deeper, we can see that the knowing faculty is not altered or affected by what is known. And this realization has liberating consequences for both our meditation practice and our lives. In meditation, as we go from painful sensation to pleasant ones, we see that the basic quality of knowing is not altered. It's simply aware of what is arising. That's the key somehow. We start to see that awareness, which is just a mental function, is unchanged by the content. I mean, it's just because, you know, stuff arises that pleasant, stuff arises that unpleasant, all that content, but there's under this, there's this awareness that's there. It's just it's totally impersonal that allows us to start to see this lack of self, this not self, this understanding. But this isn't something we figure out. This is something we experience. And that's what Joseph's driving at here. Okay. Go back to Mark Epstein's book here. He's talking, it's where he's sort of trying to sum up what he said in this whole book, right near the end of the book. This is an interesting why he's been talking about how we, in our culture, spend so much of our time blaming instead of being grateful for what's there. We complain about what isn't there or what I don't have instead of just being grateful for what we do. And he says the practice is what brings about this shift. He says, this movement from grievance to gratitude is the essence of what the confluence of Buddhism and psychotherapy engenders. Yet it is important to make sense of one's personal experiences, to face all of the distressing aspects of one's history, to name the abuses and traumas and neglect, to own one's own shame, anger, addictive cravings, and low self-esteem that one's identity has coalesced around as a result. But it's also important to know that one does not have to be defined by these things. To hold them all lightly, the way a mother holds a baby, is to let an underlying, fundamental, and impersonally entangled benevolence shine through. Eventually, through the peeling away of overly elaborated and often punitive self-concepts, one discovers this underlying truth is accessible even in the midst of everyday difficulties. This is the gate of oneness, a doorway that is nothing but open space. And then he goes on. This is the last two paragraphs of the book. If we are truly compassionate with ourselves and with others, we can and must survive the worst. What could be more true? Intensity of living and risk of openness. What could be better? As a patient of mine once quipped when speaking of how writing her memoir had helped her deal with a sudden and unimaginable tragedy that had upended her life, writing is a much better quality of agony than trying to forget. So we can't ignore, we can't pretend whatever things have happened to us didn't happen. We can't change the past. We can't ignore the past. But doesn't have to control us. The same might be said of both meditation and psychotherapy. They each encourage a willingness to face the horrors of life, those that dwell within and those imposed from without, with a courage and trust that can be hard to otherwise muster. We cannot erase our histories, no matter how hard we try, but in learning to face them with kindness, as so many of my patients have been able to do, we enter us the stream that flows gently, if not always merrily, towards inner peace. So he ends with this classic Buddhist image of the stream of things that keep, stuff just keeps happening. And we're just somehow some piece of that stream. We're experiencing it, but we're not separate from it in any sense at all. So those are my thoughts on not self for tonight. So I came across this poem looking through Dana Fald's book. I've been doing this lately. I've been sort of picking up old poetry books and just reading the whole book or big chunks of the book and going, oh, I forgot about this poem. So this poem just seems like very much on topic. It's called Setting Forth. Something will be born from this goodbye. In the pain of setting forth, something will die. With the release of the old comes a moment when nothing is firmly held, and the unknown burns the bridges of the past. When the smoke clears, my eyes seek out the new horizon. Nothing is known here, but the air is sweet, and breathing deeply, I see long dormant seeds send up their shoots from the fertile ground of change. As leaves unfurl to meet the sun, the circle is complete. I will not forget a single step of this sacred journey, nor will I let comfort lock me in its warm embrace. I do not know what fruits these seeds will bear, but I have faith that what is taking root today will surprise me with its vigor. In birth and death, the in-breath and the final exhalation, there is pain and the movement into truth. I take the step that I am called to, even if I do not know the final destination. Such wonderful advice, which is what we were talking about not self and not trying to figure it out. We can't know that final destination. We just have to take the steps and it'll become obvious. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all.